Big Blue Insider is on News Radio 630 WLAP and WLAP.com. Get on the show. Call 280-CATS. That's 280-2287. Or toll free at 1-800-606-GAME. That's 1-800-606-4263. Big Blue Insider is brought to you by UK Healthcare. Now, here's Dick Gabriel.
Welcome to the Big Blue Insider, and it's kind of a chaotic scene here at the radio station. Curtis on the other side of the bulletproof glass, and that's probably a good thing because he is just bouncing off the walls over the news that the World Cup will be coming to North America in 2026.
Actually, it's because a centipede crawled on my leg about 45 minutes ago. Yeah,
it's not about the soccer.
I mean, I'm excited about that, but I'm
that's not why you were jumping up and
trying
down,
to keep it
screaming.
Moving.
Yeah,
keep it moving. So,
oh man, I thought I had broken a story. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's coming to North America. We're not sure. I mean, it's going to be scattered all over the grid. And of the 80 games, 60 will be played here in the States. 20 will be played across the borders. 10 in Canada, 10 in Mexico, and where they're going to play them, exactly which cities they're going to be playing, we don't know yet. Plenty of time to figure that out. Plenty of good seats still available. But that broke this morning. And since then, Mr. Birch, lots more has come out. We have much to talk about tonight. We will talk some Kentucky football. Michael Smith, one of the new assistant coaches, will join us. We have not had a chance to chat with him on the air yet, so we will talk with him a little bit. Joe Masato will join us as well to talk about a lot of these headlines that we'll be discussing early in the show. But it's been a newsy little day, hasn't it?
Oh, without a question.
Starting with the announcement of the change in the transfer rule in college athletics, what used to be a situation that could just turn dastardly. I mean, and we've railed about it on the show, and this is something that Curtis and I agree on, that it had to change, and there was so much said and written about it that it was bound to change, and that is, plus with you know, the way college athletics is going through something of an upheaval right now. But basically, it's almost like basic human rights within. We talked a little bit about it last night. Don't tell me how scholarships are worthless. But there are things they need to do for these kids, and this is one of them. I shouldn't call them kids because then I sound like Calipari. But anyhow, it's as someone wrote, common sense finally added to the transfer process. The Division I Council. And again, this is member institutions. This is not some independent group that's sitting way over here deciding on these things. And Curtis, you're going to have to help me because now my computer is playing games with me. But the bottom line is students don't have to ask for permission to transfer.
And coaches / colleges can't block players from talking to other schools and going to other schools. Now, the caveat on that is conferences can make their own rules. Now, if you want to draw a parallel, it's kind of like a gambling, and with the each state can make their own rules, so each conference can make their own rules, and in theory could allow coaches to block players from going to specific schools or schools within conference, whatever, in the transfer. But as we've seen, and as we've mentioned a lot, public perception now is basically almost kind of eliminated this to a certain extent, and because it leaks out, they say my coach won't let me go to this school, even though I want to, and then everybody starts to put pressure on the coach and say how that's not fair. The other kind of big component of this is basically the way the system now works is player says, I want to transfer. He goes and tells the administration they have 2 business days to put him in this system.
2 days.
And then everyone in college athletics has access to this system, and then he can begin to be recruited by everybody else. So it's much more open.
And streamlined.
Yes. And so with that happening, of course, now the pushback would be people will worry about tampering and those kind of things. And to help with that, the NCAA also instituted higher penalties for tampering when someone gets caught doing that.
Which now they must enforce. They have
got,
I don't want to call it make an example of somebody, but they have to show that this rule has teeth. They got to do that. Mm-hmm. Or else they'll lose, and it'll force the conferences, which still have the latitude to make their own rules, as we said, to say, well, if it's just too much tampering going on, we got to stop this. But, yeah, there is a national transfer database. Mm-hmm. And what this comes down to as well so often is the controlling of the money that kids get, the scholarship money that they get. And that was the power that coaches held over them. And I have a friend who went through the same thing. He was a very good player on the D1 level as a freshman, and he just got homesick. I'm still not sure why he signed to play. He's from the East Coast, signed to play in the Midwest. And just, you know, he said it was the best offer he got, which I, you know, I believe him. I think maybe he got a little impatient. But anyhow, wanted to leave. His coach wouldn't let him. And so he blocked him everywhere he could. My friend ended up going to a D2 school. Had a nice career. Yeah. He wasn't going to be a pro anyway. But he didn't get to go where he wanted to go because this coach was so small that he wouldn't let him go. Mm-hmm. So anyhow, they're doing away with that.
Yeah.
And, again, as Curtis said, the rules about tampering will be much, much tougher. It's going to be added to the list of potential level 2 violations, which is considered a significant breach of conduct. I'm not sure what the penalties are, but, you know a level 1 is something that's going to get you on probation. That ain't going to happen, but it can. Mm-hmm. It can have teeth if they choose to enforce it that way.
Yeah.
In case you're wondering about the SEC, you were talking about some of the changes they made through the years. You might recall this from back when you were just a pup, back in the day. And people, there's a lot of people who still thought this was in place just a few years ago. It used to be that if you wanted to transfer within the conference, you had to sit out not 1 but 2 years.
Wow.
And they did away with that. That was far too damaging. But it was in place. And they finally did away with it. Mm-hmm. So that was a plus. You still have to sit out a year, and I'm in favor of that. Now, coaches can, you know, coaches are paid professionals. There's no question. However, I wish there were a rule in place where a coach, if a player could prove, or someone could prove that a coach lied to a kid and said, "Mr. and Mrs. Birch, we'd love to have Curtis come play for me," and Curtis signs, and 2 days later, I'm going across the country to coach somewhere else. Curtis ought to be able to go wherever he wants.
Yeah.
I don't know how they can fix that, but they need to.
I think you just put in a rule, if your coaches leave, you can leave. That would be a pretty easy rule to put in.
Yeah, I could see that. But, you know, what if a coach didn't even know that a school was going to offer him?
Well, that's –
You know?
That's not the player's fault.
But you signed to play at the school. You don't sign to play for a coach.
Well, that's – I mean, we could say that. But that's not true.
Yeah. Well, it is in some cases.
I mean, some, yes.
Yeah, that's the thing.
But for the, well, you still have the option to stay at the school at that point if that's the rule.
Yeah.
I think that's a pretty easy rule. And I wouldn't be surprised if that comes down at some point within the next couple years. I think it was bantered about in one of the, you know, drafts of these kind of legislations because they go through so much. But overall, I think it's just really good. It makes things really simple because, I mean, a lot of the tampering and kind of shadiness seemed to be when a guy was, like, deciding. And I'm guessing, in theory, because earlier this year, the big man from, I can't remember which Dakota, I think it was North Dakota, he put out there that he was kind of open to be recruited. And he ended up coming, I think he ended up putting his name in the draft because he was a fifth-year senior, so no harm because he'd have to start his professional career next year. Then he said he'd be open to grad transfer. And ended up going back to North Dakota State or South Dakota State. I forget which one it was. But anyway, I'm kind of...
South Dakota State had the better basketball program.
I think his name's Dom, D-A-U-M, or something like that. Yeah. But anyway, what I'm saying is it makes it open. And in theory, I guess a guy could come back if he like puts his... I don't know the official way it rules. Most times people always go. But that's one kind of outlier that you say, well, the kid came back in that scenario. So I'm guessing that just because a kid gets put in the database doesn't necessarily... mean he has to leave.
I like the fact that they have to do it in 2 days. I like the fact that within 2 days this thing can start happening because schools for quite a while, it seemed like they were almost trying to wait them out. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Wait the kids out. So it's just, it's going to be really interesting to see how it plays out at the conference level. You know what I mean? Which conference is going to step in and say, hold on now, hold on. You know, there's another rule in place, another rule change in place that says now Division I football players can play up to 4 games and still qualify for a redshirt. It had been if you play a handful of plays, your whole season of eligibility was down the drain unless there was an injury. But I like this rule as well. Mark Stoops called it a win-win. Any thoughts on that?
I agree. Four games, I don't. It would have saved, let's see, there was a couple specific examples in Jen Smith's article today. Gunnar Hoke situation when Steven Johnson had to come in and rescue the game.
Austin Peay.
Yeah, because Barker was out and they tried to, Luke Wright tried to start but just wasn't getting done.
Right.
And he's his walk-on, so you can't really necessarily blame him for that.
Right.
Gunnar Hoke would have probably stepped up in that situation and got the start. Last year, McInnes would have been punting when Panton got suspended for a game as opposed to them kind of trying to just piecemeal punt situation together.
Yeah.
So I think it's kind of a benefit. And the other side of it that people forget is maybe a guy won't try to rush back like a Steven Johnson. You know, he won't be forced back into a game because you can't put a red shirt in.
Well, that's not a good example because Steven Johnson's leg could have been broken. And you would have to drag him off.
I know exactly what you're saying.
You're right. You're absolutely right. Before we get to the break, let's get to Lou. What's up, man?
This red shirt rule is really incredible, Dick. I mean, you think about this. It takes injury completely out of the equation.
Just about, yeah.
You play in four games or less. You know, you get an extra year. The thing that intrigues me about the thing is, say you play a guy, and he's just doing terrible.
Right.
You just pull him out, and you can redshirt him after that.
Yeah, that's the first thing that came to my mind.
And here's one more thing. Say you got a freshman, and you're going into game nine. You don't get to play. You play him the last three and the bowl game, and he's a freshman next year.
Yeah, you're right.
Does it work at the end of the year, just like the beginning and the middle?
That's a good question. That's something else. Then they talked about that. Can a kid play in a bowl game? They had already been talking about that and not burn a redshirt year.
Right. So you know, there's still a few questions to be unanswered. But you know, got the option of playing a kid early. If it's not working out, you know, shelve him, and then you know, whoever's got four games to play that ain't played at the end of the year, start playing them without eligibility. I mean, it's going to be a bigger thing than people really realize, I think.
I agree. I also wonder about whatever financial impact is going to have, but I think with thanks to these TV networks, they're all making enough money, at least the power conferences are. So,
no doubt.
It's going to be fun, you know. And like Curtis just pointed out, if you've got a quarterback you're trying to keep from getting further injury, you don't have to rush him back to the field. You can play a backup guy and not lose him for the entire season. That was always kind of ridiculous.
Right. So, you know, that taking the injury completely out of the equation is different. Have a good night.
All right, bud. Thanks. 280-2287-800-606-4263. You can tweet us at Big Blue Insider 1. Basketball Wildcats met Justified today. I always try to read the faces of players in photo ops like that, and only a couple of them are smiling, but I know that that's a thing. You don't want to be grinning. But I do wonder how many of them, A, care, and B, understand who they're standing next to, brother. And being a horse racing fan, I wish I were there.
Well, I mean.
And did Justify know who he was with?
If you go to the CoachCal.com Twitter feed, all the individual pictures, the players are smiling. I found one that isn't. Zan Payne. No smile. Everybody else is.
What about Nick Richards? Because in the group shot, he was not.
Oh, he's all good, but I think, because there was a video as well, Richards' issue might have been fear, because they let him feed some carrots to Justify.
Yeah.
And he was like not getting close enough, and you know he has a wingspan to reach out, but he was short-arming it, and Justify was like, it's pretty funny, because he was trying to reach and reach, and as soon as Nick Richards saw the teeth kind of like flop out of the horse's mouth, kind of freaked out a little bit and jerked back and dropped one of the carrots on the ground.
And then the last thing you want to do in front of a thoroughbred is make a sudden movement. And I can tell you this, as someone who was dumb enough, had never been around a thoroughbred up close, when I met Secretariat, humble brag, name dropping, but and the horse was in a stall at Claiborne, and like an idiot, I reached out, I'm going to pet the horsey. And he tried to bite me, and I don't blame him because I did not know the rules. The groom quickly told me the rules. I saw those teethers coming at me, and brother, you learn quickly You don't want to be anywhere near them.
Yeah.
Back always, in just a minute. Oh.
Always flat palm it.
Always flat palm it.
When you're that's the lesson for today. When you're dealing with a horse and you're trying to give him a treat, flat palm is the key.
I had no treat. I was trying to just pet him like a
yeah, that's
like
you.
He was some sort of beer wagon
no,
horse.
You deserve what
exactly.
You got.
You're exactly right. Back in just a minute. 6:30 WLAP.
I've been through the desert on a horse with no name. It felt good to be out of the rain. In the desert, you can't remember your name, cause there ain't no one for to give you no pain.
It's about the desert or about America? You just like it?
It has horse in the title.
Ah. Welcome back to the Big Blue Insider, where we were talking about the horse Justify, but lots of other stuff going on in the first segment. We didn't even get to the big loss to the Kentucky coaching staff, and that's Edrick Floreal. We've talked a little bit of track and field really since the NCAAs began, because Kentucky had so many quality athletes performing. And by the way, we never even talked about in our discussion slash argument over who was the best athlete, the young man who won the decathlon.
And the heptathlon, indoors. And the
that's right. Tim, now his name.
Duckworth, right?
Duckworth, that's right. Mm-hmm. Tim Duckworth, and it is routinely considered in terms of the Olympics that the decathlon, it's not as much anymore, it used to be a huge deal, that the decathlon winner is the greatest athlete in the world, right?
Yeah, that was how it was. I mean, Bruce Jenner.
Yeah.
Was on the Wheaties box.
All of them
I mean, he was
Bob
the,
Richards going way back in. Yeah.
Well, even until, was that the 90s when the two guys with Reebok and then one didn't end up?
Yeah, Dan made. And, gosh, what the heck's his name?
Dan and other guy?
Yeah, Dan and other guy, yeah. One of them didn't even make the Olympics.
Yeah, yeah, but I mean, they were both decathletes.
Yeah, yeah.
So that up until then, it was just such a huge event.
And I'm sure
event.
It still is. Obviously, it is overseas, but we never even talked about that. Anyhow, Texas has hired Edrick Floreal. That is a bottomless pit of money.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people are complaining, why didn't Kentucky match? Come on now. You can only do so much.
Well, and because that's the basic tweet I sent out today is, you don't want to get in a bidding war with Texas. And someone replied to me and said, well, they didn't even try. Yeah, I'm sure they
tried.
How
do you know?
Yeah, no, well, that's what I'm, yeah, exactly. Right. I mean, I didn't want to get into a Twitter debate because it's facts we're not privy to, but I'm sure they counteroffered whatever.
That ain't going to play out on the front page.
Yeah, so that wasn't the point we were trying to make, but as you mentioned, Texas, bottomless bit of money, and has a ton of track athletes.
Facilities.
They, I mean, even from a, if you could match financially from all the other factors that go into it, you can't match that.
Whoever replaces this guy has just got to keep recruiting. Now, what he can do, or she can say, you can be a champion coming through Kentucky.
Mm-hmm.
But what he has going for him is, I've coached these people. I know how to coach you to a world record, not just an NCAA championship. So best of luck to him. And I knew for a fact, I chatted with Mitch Barnhart off the record about coaches and when you know, the name Nick Mangione came up, and he didn't say anything to me about Mississippi State. But what he did say to me was, the guy I'm worried about keeping is Edrick. I mean, he knows that people will come after Nick, if not this year, then year after year. But he was concerned at that point because, well, look what he's done.
Yeah.
You know, so that was a foregone conclusion. So anyhow, yeah, I mean, best of luck. Also, a story out of Louisville about a judge who ruled that U of L likely made a deliberate attempt to conceal records within the basketball scandal. We'll talk more about this coming up a little bit later on because we're coming up against a break. But that's a big deal in Louisville. That's the story that keeps on giving, by the way. And finally, the U.S. Open's coming up. It's being played on Long Island on the far tip, right? Traffic already is a nightmare. 15-minute drive, hour and a half. Now, those of us who got stuck in the traffic before the first NASCAR race up in Northern Kentucky, that ain't nothing, but it's still a big problem. Unless you're Tiger Woods on his yacht moored right off the coast of Long Island. Welcome back to the show. Dick Gabriel, Curtis Birch, and for those of you aching to talk some Kentucky football, we've got just the ticket. And that is on our celebrity hotline. He is Coach Michael Smith who joins us. Coach, welcome back. I said earlier I didn't think we'd had you on before, but we checked our records. I think we had you right after you got hired. So welcome back.
Thank you for having me back.
Let me start, first of all, by taking you back to your days as a player. And you were a good one, an all-Big Eight performer and an All-American. The rule change that says that a kid can play up to four games and still be redshirted, how much of a help is that, not only to the players but to you coaches?
I think it's a great deal for us as coaches because it gives us an opportunity to evaluate the young men, you know, in game-time situations. You know, a lot of these kids come in and they believe that they're ready, and I think it also will help them answer the question if they're ready. You know, we can evaluate them in game-time situations,
yeah.
And, you know, we always tell guys that film doesn't lie, and if they're able to look at themselves on film and see where they're at compared to a lot of players in the SEC or any conference for that matter,
there is no
it'll speak a lot.
There's no substitute for game situations, is there? You can practice and scrimmage, but until the bullets are flying, as they say, you can't really tell, can you?
No, you can't. I mean, if it was that easy, a lot of people would be doing it.
That's very true. So now you have settled into your gig as the receivers coach, and you're an accomplished recruiter and assistant. And how have you found things here in Lexington and at Kentucky with the work you've been able to do?
Well, first of all, the community and the city of Lexington, they've been great to myself and my family. You know, my wife and I and the kids are getting settled in. You know, the kids finished school, so that's been a great transition for us. As far as, you know, working with the staff, you know, we got a great group of people that have made this as easy a transition. Myself, you know, from the football aspect, to just feel comfortable and feel wanted and needed. So it's been real good. And then as far as the guys, the players, we're still trying to, you know, figure each other out. But it's been a great transition also in the fact that, you know, these guys are willing. They work. You know, Coach Thomas did a great job of teaching these guys how to work. And that's been easy. It's just to my coaching style and the way that I expect and demand things out of them, you know, both on and off the field, that, you know, it's going to be a process until I'm here for, I figure, a year, you know.
Yeah.
And I still have to learn some of the things about them, you know, also in their personal lives, you know, that
sure.
That it's a growing process, and it's something that I'm very excited about and very willing to accept the challenge to get these guys to be the type of players that they're capable of being.
How would you describe your coaching style?
I'm not a yeller. I'm intense in the fact that I do want the guys to go out and compete and at the highest level. But there's a way to communicate, you know, and again, each player is different, and that's what I was talking about, you know, continuing to try and learn
right.
How to communicate with each kid. But, you know, it's kind of like being a parent. You know, when I need to be stern, I'll be stern and demand things that I know from experience or for the best of each kid. I shouldn't call them kids, but young men. But I like having fun. You know, I always tell my guys football is a game, and you got to approach it that way. You know, there's a time to be serious, but there's also a time to go out and be jovial and enjoy coming to work. You know, I think a lot of people miss out on that, you know, especially in athletics, you know.
Yeah.
Because there's so much pressure because of the pressure from the fans, the administration, the pressure to win. A lot of people miss out on the fact that we're here to get these guys ready to embark on life. And, you know, our life is football, but you can do it, which I think Coach Stoops and the staff have done, you know, before I got here.
Yeah.
Go out and have fun. Enjoy doing what you do. And that's kind of how I'd see my coaching style.
As you well know, these kids today, these young men, live with their phone in their hand or in front of a computer. And I guarantee you that by the time you guys had your first meeting, they knew all about you, or they had no excuse for not knowing, because you've got a pretty darn good resume. Has that factored in? I mean, do you bring that up? Do you get an opportunity, or do you see it as instructive to talk about? I'm not saying brag about what you've done, but the number of great athletes that you've mentored, either as a running backs coach or a wide receiver, is pretty impressive.
It goes back to just being in the right place at the right time and being blessed to be surrounded by some great people, both coaches and players, that have enabled me to become the coach that I am and back then the player that I was. But to answer your question about our players, some of them don't even know what the Big Eight was. You know what I'm saying? but it's you know, I do use it, you know, because I think the one thing that kids can't deny from anybody is experience.
Yeah.
You know, and to say that I've sat in that chair, being a former walk-on, earning a scholarship, there's been a lot of trials and tribulations through my career and my experiences that I can fall back on and hopefully give them advice. Sometimes, you know, some of the bad things that I did, some of the negative things that happened to me, also, you know, yeah, not only the positive things, but to help them have a better way of looking at things. You know, I'm going to just give them advice, and they have to make the decision. You know, that's the great gift that God gave us, was choice. And, you know, through these growing processes that these young men are experiencing at these college years, they have to make a choice.
Hey, Coach, this is Curtis. And, you know, you've had a couple stops in your coaching career. So I think you'd be have a good outlook on this. I'm curious, now that you've been able to hit the recruiting trail a little bit, what is the perception of Kentucky kind of nationally now when you talk to guys about coming here?
Oh, it's very good. You know, the great thing about the areas that I recruit, you know, they're SEC country. You know, it's to be in the state of Louisiana and the big school in Louisiana is an SEC team. The perception of Kentucky is very, very high. Then, you know, being in Atlanta, Georgia, being a 6-hour ride from here, obviously they know, you know, the background and the tradition that Kentucky football has had. So it's been a great transition for me. I've been very well accepted by, you know, the coaches that I've in their schools that I recruit. So I'm just rolling with it, man. And it's been a pleasure to be out there, you know, wearing the UK on my shirt. And I had, you know, some previous relationships, especially in Louisiana, being from down there. So guys just like, hey, now you just got on blue and white, Smitty. Let's see if we can get up there to help you out in Lexington.
You also coached at one point at Arizona alongside Mark Stoops. Of course, he was on the defensive side of the ball, but you knew, obviously, of his coaching prowess, but also his famed intensity. But when you learned of him being hired at Kentucky, I know because you coached against him when you were at Arkansas, but what do you think of the way way he has built this program here? I know he's your boss now, but has that, can I assume you weren't surprised by that?
No, that's a great way to say it. I'm not surprised. You know, I think it's in his coming all the way down from his father. You know, he definitely has the work ethic and the understanding of the game that it needs to be successful. And, you know, it's something I learned a long time ago early in coaching. And as a player, you know, you want to surround yourself with people that are going to make your life better. And, you know, I think Mark has an eye for that and has done an extremely good job of surrounding himself with guys that want to make him better. You know, our staff keeps him, you know, on his toes as a head coach. And there's just a lot of knowledge. And I think Mark has also done a great job of, you know, not being a stubborn, pig-headed boss or head coach that thinks he knows it all. You know, he's a guy that listens. And, you know, he has a great heart from the fact that he wants what's best for his players. And, you know, some people call that a player's coach. And I used to always get mad at it because I used to get described that way. But in the long run, you coaching your players, so you need to be a player's coach. It's not about us as coaches or the fans or administration. It's about the players. So I used to laugh at people when they say you're a player's coach. Well, what else am I supposed to be?
Exactly.
And I think that's what Mark is, and it's a great attribute to have as a head coach.
Speaking of players, you know, your position group, wide receivers, how much have you been able to see on film? And I don't know how much contact you've been able to have with them in person or on the field, you know, both yet. If you've got to watch tape, how have you – the thoughts on what you got coming for next season?
Well, you know, spring ball went very well. I thought we made a lot of improvement. You know, of course, you know, I'm here for a reason, but you know, my challenge to those guys was we're never going to be looked at as the weakest link on this football team, you know, and that's just a pride thing, not only as a coach, but as a group, that, you know, people are going to look at us and go, hey, that's a pretty good receiving core. And, you know, working with them, you know, we're young, but we're not, you know, I mean, we are what we are and we all we got. So, We got to go out there and perform, and that's been my biggest challenge to these guys, you know, since spring, to attack the weight room with Coach Ed and his staff. That we're not the weakest link, and I think those guys have done that so far. You know, we had an OTA with them Tuesday morning, and to watch those guys run around and see where they are. You know, from a mental standpoint, it's been great because we can't have balls out there. So as a receivers coach, it's kind of frustrating, you know, because you're going through drills and stuff and you can't have a ball. But just watching them work, you know, with their footwork and their improvement in trying to be great technicians and their attention to details, It's been very, very encouraging, and it's my job and the rest of the staff to not only do it with the receivers but with every position to get everybody going in the same direction and being on the same page. And so when we do kick it off in the fall, we're well-oiled machine.
By the way, speaking of your players, Lynn Bowden has put some really weird tweets out there of late. And I don't want to get into a kid's personal business, but he has been – tweeting like something's going on. I mean, is he okay? Is everything all right with that young man?
Yes, he's fine. You know, like a lot of kids on social media today, they put stuff out there that doesn't mean anything. And us as adults, myself included, hey, man, call him. Is he in a dark spot or something like that? But
no,
Lynn is fine.
All right.
Another guy that I'm really looking forward to working with and seeing him go out and, you know, continue to raise the bar as a football player.
Speaking of him, Coach, you know, obviously he's making that transition where he played quarterback in high school last year, was trying to get his feet under him. Is he ready to make a jump? I mean, from a playmaking standpoint, he seems to be one of the better options.
I totally believe he is. You know, I thought he, during the spring, he's, like I said, we were getting used to my coaching style and the way I do things, you know, And for a guy going from the quarterback position, as he did in high school, and then doing the things, because when you watched him make plays last year, he did a lot of good things in the Wildcat, which that's still a quarterback position, you know. But to continue to develop as a wide receiver, there's a lot of technical things that he just hadn't done before that you know we're trying to work on right now. And we worked on in the spring, and we'll continue to work on throughout the summer and going into camp. That's just going to help his game, you know. And that's not just Lynn; that's everybody, you know, myself included. There's a lot of things that I have to still learn about each one of my receivers that what's their skill set and what they do best. And then we as coaches have to put those guys in the best position to be successful.
Well, one more for you as we come up against our break. We're talking to Michael Smith, the Kentucky wide receivers coach. You were talking about them learning you and you learning them. How is it with Dorian Baker? Because that young man is a live wire. He's talented, all right, but he's a lot of fun to be around. But how is he from your aspect?
He's been great. You know, Dorian, you know, coming off his injury, the thing that the biggest challenge for me was to slow him down.
Oh,
you
really?
Dorian is a high energy guy. Wanted to I just didn't want to rush him back.
Right.
You know, I tell coaches a lot of times, hey, coach, I don't need him on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. I need him on Saturday.
That's right.
And that's, you know, the same challenge I had with Dorian. You know, slow down, Bug. Don't rush this thing back. You know, and that's why we held him in the spring.
Yeah.
He's full go now. He was out at the OTAs Tuesday morning and looked great. You know, but again, it's just continuing to get him back in the groove as far as, like you were just talking about with these freshmen playing four games. It's been a long time since he's been in the game. And that's going to be an adjustment for him. Now, the transition, hopefully, will be a lot quicker for him because he has played a lot of ball here. But, again, just slowing him down, you know, because, like you said, Dorian is a high-energy guy. You know, he gives me 110% when he's on the football field. I just want him to transition that into every aspect of his life so he can be the best person and player he's capable of being.
All right, I got an important non-football one. I saw on the UK football social media you guys had a crawfish boil the other day,
mm-hmm.
obviously being a native of New Orleans.
Yeah.
Did you, like, handle all that? Were you in complete control, or did you outsource that?
I had nothing to do with it but sucking the heads and eating those tails, bro.
Was it good? Did he do it right?
Yes. The guy that did them is from New Orleans.
Ah.
So, you know, he lives here in Lexington. We had one the other day with the team, and then earlier this spring, coach had one at his house where the guys came up from Thibodaux, Louisiana.
Oh, wow.
Both of them were unbelievable, man. I bought up like 700 pounds of crawfish. And I can tell you it was good for me because, shoot, I mean, I can eat those things all day.
I bet you can. Coach, thank you so much for your time. Always fun talking football, and I hope you have a great summer.
Thank you, guys, and let's go, man. Big Blue Nation, let's get it rolling in September.
All right. Thanks, Coach. See you soon. Take care.
Thank you.
Michael Smith, who was a great, great player at Kansas State, as he said back when he was in the Big 8. Just got to tell the players it's Big 12 now. But anyhow, he played and coached at Kansas State. And, brother, if you can get it done there, you would think you could get it done anywhere. But it's not quite that easy. You got to get the right players, and he was one of them. We'll come back with more of the Big Blue Insider. Top of the hour, Joe Masato of SEC Country will join us on. Thanks again to Michael Smith for joining us and telling us a little bit more about the Kentucky receivers and if they have the kind of season that the guys he has coached in the past will have. You're going to see a lot of passes, a lot of touchdowns, no matter who the quarterback is. Go to the UK Athletics website and just check out Michael Smith's resume. He was a running backs coach before he was a wide receivers coach, and everything he touches turns to gold. And, yeah, he gets – good players to work with, but it's symbiotic. I mean, they become good players because of good coaching. So I'm really curious to see that. And as Curtis asked him about the guys, we only saw a few of them in the spring game. So,
yeah.
You know, and he's not working obviously full speed yet with Dorian Baker. That's going to be the biggest question. And how they developed Lynn Bowden too.
He's in a tough spot because, as you mentioned, the injuries and everything. I mean, they were in the spring game. You didn't have many pass catching options altogether,
no,
honestly.
No.
So it was kind of a tough deal because now his name escapes me. But the linebacker they flipped over as a tight end in that game.
Yes.
To kind of fill out the rosters, that showed how kind of injury plagued they were at that position. So he should have a lot better kind of feel for it once they get into this summer camp.
Just about a minute left as we went as long as we could with Coach Michael Smith, but I will tell you. I talked about it a few minutes ago that a judge has ruled that U of L must turn over records. These were essentially what we're going to do is find out why they chose to keep the team out of the 2016 NCAA men's basketball tournament. A judge ruled that the school has to turn over all the documents used by former President James Ramsey when he made that decision and also had to pay the court costs for Dr. Peter Hasselbacher, who had sought the records, because the documents were, quote, willfully withheld. They have to conduct a diligent search for records possessed by the school or Chuck Smert, who was working with the school. Turn it over within 30 days. We're all going to find out a lot more about what's been going on over there. Hour number two is coming up. It's the Big Blue Insider on 630 WLAP. Welcome back. Hour number two of our program. Dick Gabriel, Curtis Birch, and we have been kind of musing about the fact it's been a newsy day. There's no question, really, from start to finish, and you just heard one of the news breaks just before this segment about the former now Kentucky player who was arrested on drug charges. And to talk about that and other things, we bring in Joe Masato, beat writer for SEC Country, covers the Wildcats. Joe, before, thanks for joining us, first of all.
Yeah, for sure. Thanks for having me on tonight.
And before I get started, Curtis and I want to know that when they break California into three states, where will you declare your allegiance? Northern California, Southern California, or California?
You know, I've was not prepared to talk about that, but maybe I'll go with Northern California. Probably more space to spread out up there.
Are you a wine drinker? Is that why?
Yeah, I think I could get into it.
There might be armed conflict over Napa Valley. You know, where do they draw the border? Now, two of my best buddies from one from college and one from my first job, they live in Southern California, so I think I may have to declare my allegiance there. I hope you guys don't hold that against me.
Yeah, I hope we're not going against each other.
Well, you never know.
Well, I'll take L.A. then, the regular California in these new lines. So
now, wait a minute. Is L.A. regular California or Southern California?
No, it's regular California. It's at the bottom. That's the chunk they chunked out.
What's Southern California then?
Like San Diego, and then it kind of goes up a little bit, and then over, and then back down.
Well, I may just be a California guy. Although San Diego's really nice. See, now I can't decide. I'm torn, I tell you, torn. But we'll figure it out. I promise you that. All right, let's put Joe to work. First of all, and also, you hate to hear these things, Joe, but if a college football player decides that he's going to be a big-time drug runner, well, then he deserves what happens to him if he is indeed guilty. But these are serious charges facing Marcus Walker. And I was a little bit taken aback by the cash figure as well. Were you not?
Yeah, I definitely was. And that was the main number that caught my eye. I mean, I just wanted to follow up on it following his arrest to try to get some more details. And when I saw that number, $95,000 in cash, I mean, that kind of makes your eyes open up a little bit more when you see that big of a number, and then kind of, you know, 52 grams of cocaine, almost more than 5 pounds of marijuana. So, I mean, it was, you know, it wasn't just a possession charge. I mean, it was a trafficking charge, and there was obviously large amounts of drugs and cash on Marcus Walker and in his home with a roommate who also got arrested on the same charges.
Were you able to discern from the police reports how this all unfolded?
Yes. I mean, as much as I could tell, at first at around 11 o'clock at night on the 23rd, there was a call for a domestic disturbance. Dispatchers heard a woman yell in the background that she had been hit. For the best I can tell, and I don't want to make any assumptions here, is that Walker was home with his roommate and then his girlfriend. They both left. And when police arrived at the door, Marcus Walker answered, his roommates were gone. And police just said, they noted that they could smell marijuana, but they told him they weren't looking for that. They just wanted to make sure everyone in the house was okay.
Right.
But obviously the scene they saw, drugs were out in the open. They obtained a search warrant, and about 4 hours later, they come back, and then that's when they get the search warrant, go through the house, and make kind of a list of everything that they found.
And it was just a stunner to me. I mean, kids have been arrested for years with pot and things like that, but, you know, it tells you where we are in this day and age when they tell them up front, look, we're not here because of pot. We just want to make sure everything's okay. But that's just an enormous amount of drugs. And to me, the first thing I think of is, where does all this come from, and all that money as well? And that's what's kind of scary when you start tracing that to the connections. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. And the best I could tell by the report, they did obtain a phone. So I think they would obviously go through that. And, you know, his next court date is in a week. He did plead not guilty, so we'll see where it goes from here. But I think the amount of cash is the main concern, obviously, if you're looking at the case. And then not only that, but there was packaging material, there was money counters, I mean, stuff that you presumably would have if you were facilitating some sort of operation, even if it was a minor one.
Yeah, the little phrase that stood out to me, Joe, in your report was approximately three clear bags in plain view, and then you quoted the report, approximately the size of a soccer ball full of marijuana. That's just, I mean, that's like Breaking Bad. Obviously, we're speaking about different narcotics here, but it's just crazy. It's like a scene out of some kind of drama on TV.
Yeah, and I mean, that's what caught me. That line really kind of struck me when I was going through the report. Like, this isn't some normal drug bust. No. I mean, it seems to be a pretty substantial one when you see three bags the size of soccer balls, and then kind of is the report notes in a water heater closet, in a kitchen cabinet, underneath the bed. I mean, it was very much in plain sight for a lot of it, and then even when Walker was detained after they'd gone through the house, I mean, they said there was baggies of marijuana spread across the yard. So I don't know. It doesn't go into this, but I don't know if something happened before that sort of something went wrong, but something clearly did go wrong. But I guess we'll, you know, find out as this case proceeds.
Yeah, and it's sad on so many levels. But again, you know, my compassion only goes so far. And here's a kid, a young man who had a bright future, at least athletically, by all accounts. I mean, once I went back, Joe, and started looking at video, I remembered him as a guy. And I know they were so excited about what he might become in a talented group. And he's just kind of thrown it all away, hadn't he?
Yeah, exactly. And I think from UK's perspective, if you're looking at this through a football lens, I did ask for some comment from Mark Stoops, but they didn't have anything else to provide other than what they provided after he was arrested, and that's that he had been dismissed and there was no further comment. But I was asking, is there any concern that this might not be an isolated incident, or if anyone else might be involved, just because, you know, obviously I think if you have a player in that locker room who is moving this amount of drugs, allegedly, then I think there would be a little bit more concern. But I think from a football standpoint, that's kind of the next concern, if there is any. Maybe there's not, and maybe no one else knew.
Well, the natural inclination is to be concerned, whether you're a coach or a parent or whatever. They do test, though, football players. So yeah, maybe they think that that'll take care of it all. But But like I said, this is a guy who they thought would figure prominently into the future. But I know, you know, that they also are more concerned, as much concerned or more, about his future, period, you know, which is only natural.
Exactly, right.
Joe, what's your take on the rule changes that came out today? Specifically, I think the one that's going to impact football overall and Kentucky football specifically is the idea that now you can play four games and still maintain a red shirt.
Yeah, I really liked the rules. I mean, I thought both that rule and the rule that kind of lessens the restrictions on transfers and stops coaches or administrators from trying to block any kids from going to where he wants. I think it's a step in the right direction by the NCAA to give these kids more freedom and to make it more about them, because that's what they talk about a lot of times, but that's hardly ever the case. So I think this was a step in the right direction. And from Kentucky's standpoint, I mean, in the statement that the UK sent out, Stoops has long been in favor of this, and he kind of notes it would have helped them last year. Remember that Vanderbilt game when Matt Panton was suspended? Miles Butler was the backup kicker, was the punter, because they didn't want to pull that red shirt off Grant McInnes. And Stoops said that would have gone differently had a rule like this been in place, even if it was for just one game. But I think more than anything, towards later in the season, you want some of those freshmen to play to see what they can bring and to kind of make them happier, because no one wants, if they come here to play football, no one wants to set out a whole season.
could this have any kind of financial impact on teams, you know, because if a kid redshirts, you know, he's still on scholarship, and so now, you know, you're taking care of him for another year. In other words, I have a feeling we're going to see a lot more redshirting going on.
Yeah, you know, I think we definitely are going to see that. And, I mean, I heard some concerns being raised that, you know, if they do play when they're on redshirt, and then, you know, that might give other teams a look at, you know, what they have. Or if a coach, if he's not really what they expected, I mean, maybe even taking away a scholarship. I doubt that sort of stuff would happen, but I think there are going to be some ripple effects that we don't know at this point, but it will be a different ballgame for sure.
Well, I hadn't really thought about that, Curtis. Have you? Had you?
No, Joe. That's why Joe's so smart.
There you go.
I mean,
he
just gets to the next level.
I read it.
You were smart enough to read it, though.
See, Joe, that's a mistake, man. In talk radio, you just take credit for the ideas you read and pass them off as your own.
Have you learned nothing from Curtis? Come on.
Yeah, I wish.
You've got that. You've got the transfer rule. So, in theory, it's been a pretty good day for student-athletes, hasn't it?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think everyone was happy to see these rules, and I think these are the kind of rules we want, where no one's really, you know, upset. I mean, judging by the statement, like from Stoops' statement on a Kentucky standpoint on that second rule about transfer restrictions, he didn't act like it's going to change much, and I don't think it will. For example, when Bryant Kobach transferred earlier this year, last year,
right,
because of family issues,
right.
He wanted to get closer to his family, and ended up transferring to Toledo, I believe, a school that's on the schedule. He wasn't able to do that under the previous restrictions because they're on Kentucky's schedule, but Mark granted him that because of family issues. So I don't think much of that will change depending on those circumstances.
Joe, we had Michael Smith on. We'll leave you with this. In the last hour, talking about the wide receiver group, and we asked him about Lynn Bowden and some of these. I don't know if they're cryptic tweets, but they certainly are unusual. All you can do is monitor. But what have you made of these?
Confusion. I mean, I think the one thing from Lynn Bowden's tweets is we can't overreact to one of them. I think part of it is he's very good at, you know, stirring things up and attracting the attention, and I think that's one of the things that he kind of wants to do. But from a standpoint of him leaving, I don't know if we're ever going to learn that from a tweet or know what he's thinking about. I mean, it's just, I've kind of gotten to the point where I can't really follow all of that and base any thoughts on what some of these guys are tweeting.
Curtis is my main interpreter of Twitter, and it had him confounded, so you know where that led me, right?
Yeah, if Curtis is confused, I'm confused. Yeah,
exactly.
That's
what
we go to. Real quick, Joe, get you out on this. Thoughts on Mark Stoops' first pitch at the Legend game? Saw you were tweeting about it a little bit.
Yeah, I didn't see that till this afternoon. I was kind of blown away. He really put something on that. It looked like a strike right down the middle of the plate. I think he was practicing, probably.
You knew he's so competitive. He probably set up a bullpen at his house or something to make sure it all went exactly according to plan.
Yeah, he would have been pretty angry, I think, if he would have let himself down there. But he, as far as first pitches go, I mean, we've seen some really, really bad ones, but that's near the top of the list.
Yeah, I was going to say, we've seen people bounce it, we've seen over the head, and we've seen people way wide right or left. So, you know, if he can sizzle it in there, more power to him, right?
Yeah, exactly.
The advice I always heard was, if you're going to miss like wild high. People think you got a strong arm, so if that ever happens with me, that you'll see that. I'll hit the backstop. It'll be a nuclear loosh moment, I can promise you that. Joe Masato, SEC Country, thank you so much for your time, brother. We'll see you down the road.
All right, see you guys.
Appreciate it. When we come back, more of the Big Blue Insider, yours truly, along with Curtis Birch, here on 630 WLIP. Thanks again to Joe Masato for joining us on our Celebrity Hotline. Dick Gabriel, Curtis Birch, and you, 280-2287, 800-606-4263. Tweet us at Big Blue Insider 1. Did you see the rundown play in the Cubs-Brewers game?
No, I did not.
It's out there now. It's basically, it's kind of ticking me off, and here's why.
Ooh, angry Dick Avery, let's go.
No, I didn't say angry. How about annoyed?
Okay, that's enough. That's enough.
Well,
I'll take it.
And it's because of this. It's a blown rundown, and these things happen. You don't think you'll see it in the major league level, but runners on second and third, long story, whether it's a batted a line drive, they catch a guy off second. They've got him mm-hmm. in a rundown between second and third. Guy on first is breaking for second, and they end up blowing the rundown between second and third, and the first baseman, of course, is part of that rundown, backing up, and you know maybe he'd have a play. So there's nobody at first. So the guy between second and third makes it back to second. There's nobody at first, so the guy goes back to the back. I've seen that. We've all seen that. But now everything I'm reading is, that was a great play. That was a called play by the Brewers. He so-and-so gets credit. And you can see the runner between – I cannot remember which is which. But the runner on first did not go to the bag, did not go to second base. He stopped short, which was smart.
Mm-hmm.
And he starts pointing to the bag – to make sure that the guy coming back from third base gets on second. Well, where else is he going to go? And so where else is the other runner going to go but back to first? Fortunately, there was nobody covering. The right fielder fell asleep. But now they're calling it a great play, a design play.
That's not design.
No. It was designed at the last minute where the guy goes, touch the bag. I mean, if he looked back and saw that there was nobody at first, well, that's great. But it's almost like, okay, now look. On a line drive, you break for third, and then I'll break. You know, no, I don't know why that I don't know why that rankles me so much, except the fact that it's a blown play that has suddenly turned into something it wasn't. And again, I have seen it before. It's been a long time since I've seen a major league team blow rundown. Frankly, I saw Kentucky blow a couple of them over the last year or two, more this year than last, I think.
Yeah.
But
back in my baseball days, my
storied
Walton Verona baseball history, which consisted of one season of ninth grade baseball.
Yeah.
We blew a rundown like this. I'm remembering right.
So the other play had a design, the other team had a design play on?
No, and I don't even know how it happened, but we had this guy named Adam who was, I mean, he had a heck of an arm and could, like, was super athletic, but not a ton of control. They tried to pitch him a little bit. Didn't work out super great, but for whatever reason, somehow rundown got weird, and he was in it, and he took it, and he was trying to get the guy to go when he was going back on third, and I mean, he just rifled it, and the guy that was covering third, it was so hard, he had like no chance, because the runner was kind of blocking his view.
Right.
So it went all the way to the wall. I mean, he threw it so hard, it ended up rolling all the way to the wall. It was a bad one.
I will say this, though. That the design play in the NCAA tournament that helped put Florida in the World Series, Florida had a kid steal home, first and third, left-handed pitcher. It was perfect. So the left-handed pitcher, of course, has his back to third base, of course, facing first base, and the runner on first breaks prematurely for second base and falls on his face. And now all of a sudden all the infielders are getting, you know, they're getting excited. And the pitcher does the right thing. He steps off the rubber towards second, does not balk. But now because his attention is on the guy who fell on his face, he's thinking, oh, I got him picked off dead. Runner on third, breaks for home.
Yeah.
And a fast runner at that. And by the way, a right-handed hitter up, so it's perfect. Catcher can't see him coming. Batter steps out of the way, and just in time, kid slides in. Pitcher finally sees what's happening, throws home. Way ahead, the runner slides in safe. That was one of the greatest steals of home I've ever seen. Now, I just watched a documentary on Jackie Robinson, who stole home like half a dozen times one year, including once in a World Series. This was so great because it was a trick play. And by the way, he stole home to Robinson against Yogi Berra, who swore that he was out. And I slowed that thing down on my DVR. I could not tell either way. Robinson was called safe, of course, but anyhow, if you can, it's on YouTube, I'm sure. It's very, very cool. Welcome back to the Big Blue Insider, Dick Gabriel, Curtis Birch, and coming up in a few minutes, we are going to chat about some really interesting recruiting news that has come up in the world of college basketball. But as we mentioned, Edric Floreal is heading for the University of Texas. He was Kentucky's track and field coach up until today. Did a remarkable job with the Wildcat program and has coached it literally to new heights. And now we'll hand it off, we don't know to whom, but to somebody else, and is heading for Austin, a great place, a great school with lots of money. But Kentucky is committed to track and field like it never has before. So it's an interesting time, but we were just wondering about how indeed he has become so successful here and perhaps the ripple effect that the success at Kentucky has had on high school track and field in the state of Kentucky. So we're bringing in a pretty successful coach on his own. That is Coach Jonathan Hawks, Tate's Creek High School, and he joins us on a celebrity hotline. Coach, how are you tonight?
I'm doing okay. How are you doing?
Thanks for joining us, and congratulations. I know your girls' 4x100 team broke a state record this season. Is that right?
Yes, sir. They surely did.
Tell us a little bit about Edric Floreal and how, I mean, obviously he brought in great athletes, but it doesn't stop there. I mean, how was he able to build this program in a relatively short amount of time?
He just did a good job. I remember when he first came to Kentucky, I was just in Kentucky maybe a couple of years myself. So I've known with Coach Flo since he was in Arkansas as an athlete himself. And so for me, it was one of those things where we had conversations about the type of athletes he liked to recruit. And from my end, he's always challenged me from afar, you know, not so much in my ear every year about certain kids, just more so just wanting to, you know, he's basically telling me if I have athletes that he wanted to recruit, I need to showcase them on a national level. And if they could run with the best around the country, then he would consider, you know, looking at them. And it was kind of like a challenge thrown at me. And so if you go back and just look at the program that we've created at Tate's Creek over the past, especially my sprint side, the last 3 or 4 years, all I've done is try to, from a sprint side, give myself the best chance to get my kids recruited by Edric Floreal because he's such a great coach, and I know he can take a lot of my athletes to the next level. So he's challenged me as a coach, and like I said, I think I've kind of answered the call by trying to get my kids to the national level, but he's been that type of impact on me as a person, just a personal level.
Had you not been that aggressive when it came to considering your kids for competing at the national level prior to his challenge?
Well, just being from Georgia, and I know some people don't know that about me, but I am. I'm from Gainesville, Georgia. So in Georgia, it's really competitive. Track is really, really a big, big deal. And so when I first got to Kentucky, I didn't know the history. I knew of Tyson Gay, but that was just because of college. And so I didn't know what people, you know, thought about track in the state of Kentucky. But when Coach Flo came, it opened up so many more doors for other people, other cities, not just Lexington, but Louisville as well. I think you just have a lot of history with Mel and Bryan Station and some other schools in the state. So I think track has been really competitive. But on a national level, I know that a lot of people don't pay attention to Kentucky athletes. So, you really have to push your kids to want to look outside of Kentucky. And Coach Flo, I think he challenged a lot of us, going and getting Kiana Gray from North Hardin. He went and got Kasan James, who's also a runner from North Hardin. He's gone back and recruited that kid back to Kentucky. He went to a junior college for a couple of years. So it's one of those things where everybody wants to go run for Coach Flo. But, you know, as a coach, I'm not going to send him a kid that I know he can't, get to the next level with his coaching ability. So he does. He challenges us, as coaches, high school coaches. If we want to send our kids to Kentucky, let's be realistic and let's make sure we put our kids in the best position to go and compete outside the state and get that competition that he's wanting us to go against to be able to run in Kentucky.
You talk about some big shoes to fill. Can you imagine being the next head coach at the University of Kentucky coming in after Coach Flo? You know what I mean?
I wouldn't want to do it.
But it is a challenge and someone's going to step up to it. Coach, so, what do you do? I know you've never coached at that level, but it just starts with recruiting, right? I mean, you got to get the best athletes.
You do. He's done such a great job. Again, just from looking from afar, just seeing the type of, athletes he's had run. Look at the success from the girls' side the last couple of, not last 4 or 5 years, and then look at the boys started to make noise this year. So you start to see that he was gelling that program together on both sides of the field. And so I think it's a big loss. You know, it's hard to really replace a guy like that. But what you can do is bring somebody in with the same type of energy, the same philosophy. And I think with Mitch Barnhart and that staff over at UK, I think that they'll bring someone in that can continue to keep the same type of energy going. I think Kentucky's done a great job showcasing its facilities over the past 4 or 5 years, having the indoor meets. So I think that he set it up for someone to come in and pretty much continue to take it to the next level.
Okay.
I think his ability to coach, though, hurdlers especially, you take a dip in that point because he is such a great hurdler coach, and I think a lot of people come to him because of being, you know, great hurdlers themselves.
You know, it's interesting you say that because Curtis and I were talking about the fact that, you know, you just can't get over the fact that athletes have developed so superbly there. And you, of course, coach runners and hurdlers. And, you know, there's so much that goes into it that we don't really understand. I mean, you can't just go out to practice every day and say, run as fast as you can. We'll see how you do. There's so much technique involved. And Sydney McLaughlin tweeted out that, you know, or was quoted as saying, She never really thought she ran as well as she could this year, that she had to work on this and that and this and that. There's so many different techniques that go into all this stuff, and you guys have to stay on top of all that, don't you?
Yes, sir. A lot of track, and especially with football as well, a lot of track, though, is about mental. For me, I do a lot of mental workouts with my kids. I do a lot of texting and talking to a lot of kids, pulling to the side and really having 35 to 40 minute conversations with them about things outside of track. And I know Coach Flo does that a lot because when kids go through injuries, a lot of the times it's hard for them to bounce back. At Sydney. She had an injury earlier in the year. I know he had to do a lot of maintenance work to kind of get her, you know, he still wanted to run her, but at the same time, he wanted to protect her so that she could run her best, knowing that, you know, there was a goal in mind at the end of the year.
Right.
So, it's a lot of mental work that goes into training athletes, and my girls' team actually made it to nationals, so we'll be running in North Carolina this Saturday, and so it's another one of those things where it's a big stage. So in order to have your athletes mentally prepared for it, it takes a lot more work building up to it throughout the year, and I think that he's done a great job with Jasmine, one of the hurdlers over there.
Look at how he
was able to, you know, get her to really look at her sophomore season and say, okay, well, in your junior season, you need to come back. And maybe that talk behind closed doors is about losing a couple of pounds and maybe being a little bit more leaner so that she can get over the hurdles a lot quicker and get a foot down and foot placement and technique. So there's just so many things that goes into track outside of what people see, and that's the part that I think he's mastered.
Well, and we were just talking again the other night about the fact that Kendra Harrison missed out on the Olympics and was feeling sorry for herself, and he kind of browbeat her into running in the very in the Worlds in London, and she didn't want to, and he basically made her do it, and here she breaks a world record. So that's probably the best example of what you just described.
Yes, sir, and I'm really good friends with Kenny as well. She's done a heck of a job just mentally coming back from things that happened. I mean, I was afraid to text her after she false start to get her set. And I was afraid, you know, because in a moment like that, you know, you don't want to bother anyone, but she's such a warrior. And I think her message is loud and clear. You know, you fall down, you get back up. And I think Coach Flo, if it wasn't for his guidance, I don't think that she would have been able to bounce back from that because he's had so many great athletes that he's coached. And I think she's just another example of perseverance, and I think he's really instilled that into her and a lot of his athletes.
Well, I'll let you go with this. I'm going to ask you a question that I've been dying to ask a track coach, and I don't know if you can answer this or not, but my nephew is a shot putter in high school in Louisville, and he was behind an all-state performer, a guy who ended up with a full ride to U of L, and so, you know, that was kind of his role model. And you know, kids throw the discus and, you know, the running events we all know. But when it comes to the field events, I think those are fascinating. And my question to you is, how does a kid look at the event and say, I want to be a pole vaulter? You know what I mean?
Right.
Of all events, I want to grab that big stick and run down the runway, jam it into a hole in the ground, and try to jump 17, 18 feet. How in the world do kids decide to do that?
I'll be honest. I've learned kind of the secret behind it, but as a coach, you go back and you look at kids that are, and I hate using this word, but it's called reckless. You look at kids that are not afraid to go and do skateboarding. You look at a lot of gymnasts. They're not afraid to go up and they're not afraid of heights. So you look at some of your faster kids that are not afraid to just attack workouts. And some of them are, they're probably not your fastest sprinters, but they have foot speed. And you look at them, you go, okay, either it can be a long jump or it can be a high jump or it can be a pole vault. And you know that you're probably stacked on your team. So you're like, to give this kid the best success, what could I do to give him the best opportunity on our team? And so that's how you introduce it to a lot of kids. Like, okay, Hey, why don't you come and try this? And then especially a lot of gymnasts, they're not afraid to go up and down.
Yeah.
So it really, some kids really just take it and they fly. I got a kid right now that I'm really excited about in the next couple of years. He's a gymnast, and I introduced it to him, and he's all over it now. So we'll see. We'll see how it goes.
Well, there's my answer. That's what I wanted to know. Well, Coach, listen, thank you so much for your time on short notice. Best of luck to you and your girls in Nationals.
Much.
Keep us posted.
Okay, no problem. Thanks, Coach.
Appreciate that. Take care.
That's all right.
Jonathan Hawks, Jayhawk, they call him. He's the track and field coach at Tate's Creek. And again, a great relationship with Edric Floreal. And I wouldn't want the job either. At least he's honest, but somebody's going to take it. It's going to be interesting to see what happens there. I mentioned recruiting, and Curtis, a young man is coming to play his high school, or his college basketball, I should say, here in the state of Kentucky. He's a 5-star athlete, but he is not, shockingly, going to play for the Wildcats.
Charles Bassey is reclassifying from 2019 to 2018 and is going to go to Western, be a Hilltopper.
Not that.
A super surprise that he is going there. The reclassification had been rumored, but nothing had ever been nailed down, and it was officially made public today. First reports out there, and then WKU themselves confirmed them all tonight. He's a 5-star. He was number 3 in the 2019 rankings, player overall. He's a top 5 player in the 2019 class. I'm guessing he'll end as a top 10 guy. Going into Western next year. Now, Western has had some 5-star players last year, obviously. We all followed along with the Mitchell Robinson saga. He was on campus. He was off. I saw Charles Bassey at the Nike Hoop Summit
right. In
Portland. I thought he was one of the 5 best players on the court, and that included guys that are going to college next year. I think he's super talented, an impressive rebounder. If you wanted to, like, go far out, I don't know if he'll project into the NBA greatly. We'll see.
Even though he's a 5-star?
Even though that he's a 5-star. His game, it's just a translation of game, much like we talked about Hamidou Diallo's
right. Game
was set more for the NBA. I think it's kind of the opposite with Bass. He's a bit of a banger and does some things that aren't valued as much on the next level as they used to be. But I just think he's really, really impressive. He set the rebounding record for the Nike Hoop Summit game. He had 17 rebounds in 24 minutes.
Which tells you a heck of a lot about his desire.
Yeah, and I mean, he's going up against Bol Bol, who's going to be at Oregon this year.
Yeah,
and Kentucky
going up against both of them, isn't he? Both Bowls.
Yeah, well, when you look at Bol Bol, sometimes you wonder if it's two people stacked on top of each other because he's so tall and has such long arms, but he just took him down, and you know, after the game, Bol said just how strong he was, and is one of the strongest players he's gone against, and I just find him really impressive. I do want to say this. I've said this before. I think I said it last year during the Mitchell Robinson recruitment and eventually signing with Western. One, very similar to Robinson, Bassey played this year at Aspire Academy in Louisville.
Right.
Before that, he was at the prep school Aspire that was in Texas. At the same time, when he was freshman, sophomore year, he was obviously highly thought of then. Stansberry was an A&M assistant.
Right.
They have a long-standing connection. Also, there's his guardian has a strong relationship with WKU, one of the players that is currently on the Western's roster. Is also, I don't know if he's the guardian of this guy or not, this kid. Now, you know, now he's not a guardian because the kid's in college, obviously. Well, I mean, you know how that works.
I understand, yeah.
Trying to say, but he has a lot of ties to Western and Stansberry, and everybody loves to make snide remarks about Rick Stansberry, and listen, they could be true, whatever, I don't care, but if you're a Kentucky fan and you get mad on the internet when someone says PayPal Cal, LOL, put your banners up with Velcro and all
right. That
nonsense, you
That's
can't
right.
turn around and make the same comment about
That's
Stansberry.
Exactly right.
It just is so frustrating to me, and everybody does it, And listen, the whispers are the whispers. But Western, someone pointed out, and I'm guessing this is true, that they have, I mean, they're a top 10 win program of all time, right?
Right. Uncle Ed Diddle.
They're not nobody. I mean, they are in a lower conference now, right. But that is a strong tradition of basketball. And no question. To just dismiss them the way that the only way they're going to get any players. Now, granted, this was just like last year, kind of a culmination of a lot of things. Stansberry's relationship with the Guardian, with the relationship that was formed when the kid was young in Texas, to get this high of a guy. But Western Kentucky can get 4 and 3, 4, and every once in a while a 5-star player. And I don't think there's anything, you know, out of the ordinary about that.
Well, you said it yourself in that he's almost like a legacy. And that was the same thing with Mitchell Robinson. And then one of the reasons he left, Lord knows why he ultimately left, was because he had a relationship with a man who was at Western and then left.
Godfather. It was
exactly.
His godfather.
His godfather, yes. Literally his godfather. So, you know, that helps explain things, especially if a kid's only planning to be there a year. I'm not saying that's what kind of player Bassey is. And the other thing to remember as well, and I hear what you're saying about skills that don't right now necessarily translate the way they used to the NBA, simply because the Warriors have changed the game. It's no longer an inside-out game. It's an outside-in game. There will always be a place for defense and rebounding in the NBA, but you've also got to be able to shoot the three. May I direct your attention to DeMarcus Cousins? But look, nobody says and nothing says this kid or this young man has to go to the NBA in 1 year. That doesn't validate him as a player or as a 5-star. But I'm with you on the whispers, and you're right. You're absolutely right. And I have a friend who used to be a college basketball coach. He's retired now, and he was an honest guy. He really was. And I will tell you that he coached at a smaller school. He couldn't have cheated if he wanted to. But he had the same kind of thoughts you did, and he said, look, if you're saying that, then what you've got to do is stipulate to the fact that they simply outbid your school. You know, if you're believing that that's going on, then odds are they outbid your school. And if you're willing to say that, then cut loose. Otherwise, shut up. Not saying it's not going on, but you're right. And, you know, it's really not fair because you're guilty until proven innocent. We'll come back and wrap this up in just a minute with some fantastic facts on 630 WLAP. Our thanks again to our guest tonight. Kind of guest heavy, but Jonathan Hawks, the track and field coach at Tates Creek High School, Michael Smith, wide receivers coach at Kentucky, Joe Masato from SECCountry.com. Curtis, it's been a newsy edition of the Big Blue Insider.
Yeah, that's why we like them, especially in the summer months.
So we're going to wrap things up with some fantastic facts. And I know that you probably saw the video, maybe not, of the raccoon scaling the building in St. Paul, Minnesota. Did you see that?
Yeah, I'm aware.
And he is safe. They put cat food in a trap, and, you know, he was able to... I don't know how he knew the cat food was on the roof. I guess they told him or showed him a picture or maybe showed him a menu. I don't know. So we'll go back to a fact that we have thrown out there before. Raccoons are very smart. They can open complex locks in fewer than 10 tries and repeat the process if the locks are rearranged or turned upside down. And they will also remember solutions to problems for up to 3 years. So I guess in 4 years, that same raccoon could find himself in the same jam, right?
Yeah. That's a lot longer than I remember things.
What's your name again? First online transaction ever. This internet we know is here to stay. First online transaction ever. No, it wasn't somebody buying a flashlight off the internet or anything, a tactical light. It was Stanford students buying marijuana from MIT students.
Sounds about right.
They were probably the only people on the internet at that time. I knew this about Liam Neeson, the actor, the guy who's in Taken. I have a certain set of skills and all that stuff. And he was also quite the physical bad man in the Batman movie. You know, he once turned down an opportunity to play James Bond because he didn't want to star in action movies. I guess he was still doing Shakespeare movies or whatever. How'd that work out? I guess he's all right. Taken, he made a few bucks.
He's doing okay, I think.
Queen Elizabeth II, a huge fan of the Golden Girls, invited the cast to come perform a 7-minute skit at the London Palladium. I certainly hope she paid more than scale, right?
Thank you for being a friend.
I can't top that. Thanks tonight for all your calls, your tweets, your comments. For Curtis, Dick, Gabriel, that's it. Good night from Lexington.
The Jets got a suicide week.